I'm Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, the toll of war on wildlife. We'll spend this hour with an evolutionary biologist and environmental diplomat who coordinated a census of animal species battered by 3 decades of war in Afghanistan in preparation for creating its first ever national park. We'll talk about discoveries of species assumed to be extinct in the country. We'll hear descriptions of Afghanistan's most beautiful places that might change the way you think about it. And we'll find out why our guest was often frustrated with the way the U.S. spends foreign aid money. Our conversation starts after a short break. That's been at war since the late 1970s, it's easy to understand how the people of Afghanistan might be traumatized. But it's not only the people. Consider the effect of 4 decades of landmines and aerial bombing campaigns and combat on wildlife. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. In 2006, the Wildlife Conservation Society launched an ambitious effort to survey animal species in Afghanistan, including species like snow leopards and Marco Polo sheep, in preparation for the creation of the country's first ever national park at a spectacular canyon complex called Bande Amir. Alex Dagan was tapped to head up the endeavor, which was perhaps the best possible use of his unusual background as an environmental lawyer, evolutionary biologist, and diplomat. Dagan is now CEO and co-founder of Conservation X Labs, and he's written a book about his years in Afghanistan called The Snow Leopard Project and Other Adventures in War Zone Conservation. He joins us from NPR in Washington. Alex, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
I have to tell you, I was drawn to this book as soon as I realized what it was about, because I realized I had never really thought about the environmental toll of war. Landmines and bombings obviously are bad for landscapes and habitats. What specific effects does conflict have on wildlife?
You know, one of the challenges, I think, first of all, is just the decline of the rule of law. And with the decline of rule of law, the decline of all those regulations that protect wildlife, that protect species, that protect the management of natural resources. So one way just to think about it is, you know, the rangelands in Afghanistan, a country that is 80% rural and dependent on domestic wildlife, are also those things that sustain the prey base for things like snow leopards, as well as sort of some of the majestic animals like the Marco Polo sheep. And so when there's mismanagement of the range, both the humans and the wildlife suffer in that case. And that's, you know, when countries are flooded with weapons, those weapons are turned on the animals. When there is no more, not a strong central government, then the borders become porous and wildlife trade accelerates. So those are some of the things we saw in Afghanistan, in addition to just the destruction of the physical environment.
How did the Afghanistan Biodiversity Conservation Program come into existence? Whose idea was it?
Yeah, this was a brilliant conservation biologist, one of the toughest people I know, a guy named Peter Zoller, who had been working in the tribal regions across the border in Pakistan on this flying squirrel, who recognized the opportunity to do something in Afghanistan, essentially did a super quick initial survey under the guise of the UN Environmental Program, and then used that to get USAID to fund the program and recruited me because I had served in Iraq on rebuilding science in Iraq and also had played some role on the environment, particularly the wetlands to the south, to get me to leave the State Department at the time and join this endeavor to help set up Afghanistan's first national park, working with the Wildlife Conservation Society, that's better known as the Bronx Zoo in New York.
Reading about your background, I imagined you at career day when a student puts up their hand and says, what do I have to do to follow your career path? Can you talk a little bit about that career path?
Yeah. So the first thing I'd tell them is maybe less graduate school, but the because there was way too much graduate school involved in doing this. Part of the challenge was I've been always interested in sort of both policy and the role of law in determining literally the social contract or the fabric of society, and my love of science, in particular how science is used for conservation. So, you know, I started as a zoology political science major as an undergrad, actually went to law school, and my first year of law school was found myself in the Soviet Union that had just fallen apart on rewriting Russian law and setting up environmental litigation firms there. Had at the end of law school clerked for a U.S. federal court, had a chance to go work at the World Court, but missed science too much. Went back to do graduate work at the University of Chicago, working on understanding extinction in animals of complex behavior, which in this case were 12 different lemur species in Madagascar. Was going to be a professor, and after 3 years of living in a tent in Madagascar, came back to the United States, and a week after I came back, 9/11 happened. And I just realized that being a professor, being an academic, wasn't what I could do, that I needed to serve. So there was an amazing program called the AAAS program, American Association for Advancement of Science, that put scientists into government, got into the State Department, and then within 3 months, we had, because we had just invaded Iraq, signed up to go to Iraq to actually redirect former weapons scientists, got deeply involved working for the Office of the Science Advisor, the Bureau of Near Eastern Affairs, served under the Coalition Provisional Authority, and started working on how science and conservation can serve as a means for diplomacy, and then got this incredible opportunity to go to work in Afghanistan, which is probably one of the best jobs you can have in your life.
The site of this national park, Bande Amir, is comparable in some ways to the Grand Canyon in the U.S. And again, I think this is the kind of thing, the kind of information about Afghanistan that doesn't always penetrate the U.S. consciousness. Can you tell us about what it's like there?
Afghanistan is a spectacularly beautiful place. And one of the challenges is that most of the images that we see on the media don't reflect that beauty, right? You have the western end of the Himalayas that punch into the center of the country. You have, you know, vast wetlands. You have beautiful plateaus and pistachio savannas in the far west of the country. You have incredible sandy deserts in the far south, and beautiful lakes like Bande Amir, which is a system of six different lakes that are created by the formation of supersaturated calcium carbonate in the water. It's the same process that creates stalactites and slagmites, and it looks a lot like Mammoth Hot Springs in terms of those pools. But if you took those pools and took that edging, that wall around them, and made them 60 feet high and higher, and placed it at the bottom of the Grand Canyon, populated it with two half-done Buddhas that were never finished, and threw in some leopards and ibex, you would have this national park.
I guess I shouldn't have been, but I was surprised to learn that prior to the Soviet invasion, tourism was like a huge industry in Afghanistan, number two source of revenue.
That's absolutely right. It was a great stopover on the hippie trail, and for many people is one of the favorite stopovers that people had, because the people are unbelievably generous. They are super kind, and the landscape is incredible. It is a place of sublime beauty. And what some of the images from the 1970s of Afghanistan were of women in miniskirts, a very modern society that due to, you know, the Soviet invasion followed by the fight against the Soviets that led through the Mujahideen that we supported through the United States led to indirectly to the rise of the Taliban. A civil war in the country for control of the government, followed by the U.S. invasion and, you know, the stalemate that we've been in for the last decade plus.
So many of the things we've heard about Afghanistan here in the U.S. cause us, I think, sometimes to think of the people there as victims, which they are and have been. But you present this portrait of them as survivors, which is such an important shift in perspective.
Yeah, they are literally some of the most generous people that I have met in terms of, and I at times would sleep on the floors of their houses. It was actually a far safer place to sleep. There's always two sort of approaches you can take to security. One is you beef up, armor up. The second is you integrate and you use that integration and the social cues and the social networks as part of it. And we chose that latter approach. We didn't have guns, for instance. We didn't wear Kevlar vests. And one of the things that allows you to do is actually better understand the society and the people. And for people who, you know, they have been refugees for 30 plus years, they have been under constant warfare forever. And I found this true not only of Afghanistan, but many of the other places I worked, Iraq, where I spent a lot of time outside of the green zone, engaging scientists and helping redirect former weapon scientists into civilian science and rebuilding civilian science. In all these places, the majority of the people just want to live their lives, whether it's the Soviet Union, Iraq, or Afghanistan. And that is especially true in places that have been through conflict, that are in conflict. The rebounding effect of normalcy is very strong in terms of how people try to bring that back to how they're living and what they're living. And in some cases, it's really difficult. We had a guard who later actually, because he was super competent, rose to other positions within the organization, who was Ismaili. He was from Bamiyan. He was literally a descendant of Genghis Khan's troops in the region. He had Asiatic features. He couldn't grow a beard. And so under the Taliban, the rule was if you didn't have a beard that was at least 2 fists long from your chin, you would be thrown into prison until you could grow a beard. So for 5 years, he never left his house.
Wow.
And actually, he would make carpets in his house. He was productive, but just what people had to go through, where literally a wrong turn could lead you to a checkpoint that resulted in your slaughter and the slaughter of your children, being 5 feet over when a mortar hit your house or, you know, and wiped out your kids. For people to go through that and still remain, retain their humor, retain their resilience, retain their strength, it was instructive to me to complain a lot less in my everyday life.
What is the Afghan sense of humor like?
It's constant. It's awesome. It is making fun. It is an Asiatic society, so it is a complex culture where you're trying not to lose face, but at the same time, you can use humor as a way of preventing people from losing face. We had a delicate situation where we all went out on an extraordinary picnic to an area right outside of Kabul as an office. We had been working 7 days a week for the first year before we even took Fridays off, which were the equivalent of the weekend. And we had maybe taken half a day off at that point. And we, you know, that hard work, we decided as an office we were going to go on a picnic. And one of the unfortunate things is they have this, the mulberries in Afghanistan, like much of the fruit, are actually closer to the original genetic cultivated plant.
All right, hold on 1 second, Alex. I need to take a quick break and I want to get the whole story. So my guest is Alex Dagan, CEO and co-founder of Conservation X Labs. We're talking about the Snow Leopard Project and other adventures in war zone conservation. That's his new book. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with the CEO and co-founder of Conservation X Labs, Alex Dagan. We're talking about his book, The Snow Leopard Project and Other Adventures in War Zone Conservation. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. Before the break, you were telling us about the Afghan sense of humor and a picnic you took and some mulberries.
Yeah, so mulberries in Afghanistan, like the melons, like other fruits from the region, are spectacularly good. The entire office overindulged in the mulberries. And one of the side effects that, you know, I thought the Afghans probably would have known was the entire office had terrible diarrhea and were fighting literally for those bathrooms as a result. And everyone got mad at the person who organized the outing, but then were also found it hugely humorous and never sort of never sort of relented on him about that fact ever since. And that was it. It was fun. I mean, Afghanistan, it sounds like it's a crazy thing to say, but it was an enormous amount of fun, despite the fact that there were real dangers, you know, real problems we faced. There were threats that we had to deal with. Some of our colleagues, you know, got killed. And this was the life that people dealt with, and they dealt with those cards exceptionally well.
So before work could begin on creating this park, everyone needed to know what sort of wildlife remained in the region. We've already talked a little bit about snow leopards and Marco Polo sheep. There were also species thought to be extinct, right, from Afghanistan.
Yeah, so the thing that's kind of surprising about Afghanistan is people know of it as this incredible cultural Silk Road that served as the crossroads between Eastern and Western society. And in fact, people may know of lapis lazuli, which was the blue on King Tut's mask. It's actually mined out of a mountain in Afghanistan, not far from where the snow leopards are. But people may not realize that Afghanistan very much was a biological Silk Road that united animals and plants that are found in Europe. So you have things like brown bears, Asiatic black bears, Africa. So you have hyenas in Afghanistan, not what you normally think of in terms of the country. And then Indo-Malaysia, together within this single country, you have primates in Afghanistan. You have more cat species, at least historically, than probably were present in all of Africa. And some of those species are things, incredible things, like the Asiatic cheetah, a separate species than, or subspecies than the cheetah that's in Africa. But you also had this awesome animal that that I call the vampire deer because it looked like Bambi with fangs and is better known as the musk deer. And literally where perfume came out of was because of the scent glands on its stomach. And it hadn't been seen for a very long time since the Soviet invasion. We weren't sure of its existence. The places we were looking for it was, near in Nuristan, in the regions that were some of the most dangerous in Afghanistan, not far from the Wagal Valley that people have heard about, on these incredibly steep hillsides. And it took a long time for us to verify that it was there, but we would set up, part of our surveys was, you know, going out into the field. The Himalayan part of Afghanistan, this super thin peninsular arm that reaches out and touches China and results in actually one of the biggest time zone shifts crossing a border anywhere in the world. You have to reset your clock 3.5 hours because Afghanistan and China are in a single time zone. Would take us weeks by yak and horses to be able to get into those areas to survey for Marco Polo sheep and snow leopards. We'd set up camera traps in this other part of Afghanistan, the part that's on the border of Pakistan that is deeply verdant and forested, both, you know, oak forests as well, and cedar forests and pine forests, all in this region. We would do surveys in these wetlands. And that was because we weren't sure of what effect the wars actually had on wildlife. And one of the most surprising finds was finding the musk deer still in existence, along with a lot of other wildlife. So the effects of war are complex. You have definitely clear negative effects, but also some of the isolation can be positive in the long run.
And if confronted by a member of the Taliban when doing this sort of survey of the animal population, I guess one can only hand over one's binoculars.
You know, why not have them help you count birds and get them to recognize? I think this was actually a really important point. I got asked the other day by a soldier who was in Kandahar how we dealt with corruption. And what was pretty extraordinary was while lots of organizations had huge problems with corruption, we never did. We weren't asked for bribes. In fact, there was an incredible enthusiasm by the Afghan people for what we were trying to do. And part of the reason was we tied the uniqueness of the wildlife in this country to the identity of the people. People who, again, were refugees for the last 20 years to 30 years growing up in places like Pakistan and Iran and the Emirates. For them, you know, restoring the wildlife was a way to actually help restore their own identity. And 80% of the people live don't live in the city. And because of that, I think that there is an identification with wildlife that was important that resulted in us being successful. This was, of all the places I've worked around the world, whether it's Central America, South America, Russia, places like Madagascar, this was the easiest place I found to do conservation.
You were there in 2006 and 2007. You were aware of the questions this raised about, you know, why do this work that ostensibly benefits animals when the people of Afghanistan had such great needs? And you really were at peace with the answer to that.
Well, yeah, I think it goes back to that idea. If you are talking about where the people are, they're not necessarily in the cities, but that's where the international donors were spending their money. That's where, in fact, much of the money actually went back to experts hired by those international donors. We believed in training Afghans to fulfill those roles. But the other part of it was by actually protecting the natural resources, we were protecting those resources for the people who were dependent on them as well. And I think that's part of the reason we had their support. We also, this wasn't sort of a neo-colonial conservation effort, but this was one where we empowered communities to actually have control over their natural resources. And one of the things we didn't realize was that by having small villages around that first national park have elections, by bringing together the local, provincial, and national governments in the management of those natural resources, along with those elected representatives, we actually were building democracy and didn't realize it. And when I saw the first meeting of the conservation committees that were set up to run the national park, and they were voting on their rules and offices, I felt like I was watching the founding of the United States. And I was at the Constitutional Convention, and you know, the hair on the back of my neck rose because I was seeing the birth of democracy, which as a concept is exceptionally hard to introduce to people and to make real. But giving people, tying to something that they fundamentally understood, which were those natural resources, that their lives depended on it, brought substance to a concept that is hard maybe to define in some ways for people that have not encountered it.
You and your colleagues did discover a troubling trade in animal pelts. I guess they would have been poached had the rule of law really been fully in place. But you linked that trade to U.S. military personnel stationed in particular areas. So talk about what you found and what you did to address it.
Yeah, it wasn't just solely U.S. military personnel. It was actually the humanitarians that were there in Afghanistan, the contractors that were there in Afghanistan to help the people. And part of the issue was, I think that there was just a lack of awareness. The trade had existed at extremely low levels, but those levels went way up with the presence of international forces. And one of the things we started discovering were pelts. In fact, someone had ordered a whole series of snow leopard comforters, with each comforter actually, you know, potentially taking up 10 snow leopards. And that one order had the potential to wipe out every snow leopard in the country. And there were pelts of lots of other endangered animals. When we started talking to the military police on U.S. bases and the NATO bases that were in Afghanistan, the response was amazing. The military became one of our best partners in the country. They were extraordinary partners to actually have. And they started shutting down any of the sellers that were selling wildlife that was, you know, supposedly protected, endangered under Afghan law, international law, as well as U.S. law, all which governed their transactions. And one of the best and most touching moments for me was I got a call from the traders. We had also done some outreach programs. We had put, you know, posters and stories in the expat magazines, posters in the airports. We had trained the airports to actually seize the animal. I almost started missing flights because there were so many people that they were so effective at seizing skins, and they would insist on showing me every one that they had seized when I would be entering or leaving the country. But one of the things that happened was I got a call from the snow leopard dealers, the skin dealers themselves. And they wanted to see me. And I was pretty sure this was the end. And I was like, well, you know, if you go out, this was a good way to do so. Again, we didn't have guns. And I just sort of expected them to come with the violin cases, you know, take out the for some reason, I was imagining 1920 Tommy guns, but AK-47s would have been more appropriate, and just mow me down at the spot. And they came in and they said, could you run the training sessions you've been running for everyone else for us? And it was the last thing I did before I left the country. It was one of the most powerful things, I think, at least for myself, that I did, that they did actually care, and they wanted to know a way to help protect it. Ultimately, the Bronx Zoo started going back to U.S. servicemen and training U.S. servicemen before they flew to Afghanistan, which was even better. But it was... you know, these young servicemen that actually were unbelievably determined to find out everything they could about the wildlife in Afghanistan and help protect it once they found out what was going on.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, let's go to the phones now. Kelly is on the line in Dobbin, Texas. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
Good. I just had a quick question. I was just curious, having heard where he was stationed and how much time he spent just, you know, on the outskirts and in the village areas, do you think that you would have been as successful had you been in that same position as a woman?
It's a great question. We did have women on my staff, including my wife, and she actually... positioned herself every day within the Ministry of Agriculture. We had two partners, the Ministry of Environment, which was the National Environmental Protection Agency, is its formal name, led by the former grandson of the former king of Afghanistan, and then the Ministry of Agriculture. And every day she worked alongside Afghan colleagues, because one of the most important things for us to do was to empower them. And so she's a conservation biologist, and, you know, I think they liked her better than they liked me, and she was really well respected. One of the tougher, you know, one of the things we did was we had a, you know, our office was deeply supportive of the role of women in Afghanistan, in of training of women, of giving opportunities to women in terms of conservation. As conservation biologists, because we believed, you know, why would you disenfranchise half of the country to be able to do so? But at least when it came to the example of the female, my wife in particular, and others that we had in the country, they were well respected.
You were born in Iran, right, and raised in the U.S.?
Yeah, I came here when I was 2 years old.
What did Afghans make of your identity?
One of the, I have probably the worst accent in Farsi ever, and I sound like a character from Fast Times at Ridgemont High when I speak Farsi. It is this weird Southern California accent that comes across in the Farsi. The first thing that happens is I start speaking Farsi, which is not Dari either, and people just start laughing. The great thing is it actually it helps people warm up to me, because at that point there's nowhere to go but up with respect to it. And I think it helped a lot. I think it helped that I came in expecting Afghanistan to be Iran. It is far from it. It is its own very unique identity, its unique food, its unique cultures. And one of the things I learned was to really appreciate everything that it meant to be Afghan. But it did help to be able to speak the language, even badly, to be able to build that bond, because people appreciated that, you weren't parachuting in.
What did it take to convince local farmers to stop shooting animals that they feared were preying on their livestock?
That's a huge problem. It's a huge problem actually all over the world, including in the Western United States. You know, part of it is, how do you actually better protect the animals and the livestock that people have? The second part is providing rebates. We do this thing where we expect those people who bear the greatest burden in conservation to pay the greatest cost for it. And so how do we shift some of that within what we're trying to do? And then I think the third part was actually giving them evidence that rates of predation by things like snow leopards versus just death due to disease were very low. So that was the approach we took.
My guest is Alex Dagan, CEO and co-founder of Conservation X Labs. We're talking about his book, The Snow Leopard Project and Other Adventures in Warzone Conservation, about the research leading up to the founding of Afghanistan's first national park. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Alex Dagan. He is CEO and co-founder of Conservation X Labs, and we're talking about his book, The Snow Leopard Project and Other Adventures in Warzone Conservation. It's about his time with the Biodiversity Conservation Program in Afghanistan in 2006 and 2007. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 800-933-5372. You're candid here, Alex, that you were often disappointed with how USAID accounted for money and how it measured success. You note that aid agencies like take the exact opposite approach to the burn rate of their available cash than, say, a startup business would.
Yeah, and it was interesting because in some ways this was a startup in Afghanistan. This is exactly how I felt like. And in fact, the first month we literally operated out of the equivalent of a guarded motel room, took over the computer lab at that motel. Is this euphemistically named place called the Park Palace, as well as every picnic table in the place to run the organization. And then in 30 days had teams in the field doing the first surveys. One of the challenges we faced was, and it wasn't just our challenge, it really was the challenge that USAID had, was the way they were under incredible pressure. They were in pressure from the U.S. Congress, from others, in terms of the impact that they wanted to have to restore Afghanistan toward normalcy. You know, and that's a really tough project after three decades of war. Literally the country, the buildings, the towns were ground down into dust. And in some ways, I see that layer of, you would dig down some places into the dirt and you'd see gun shell casings. And, it almost created a new geological layer for us. But the effects of that pressure was, how do you actually measure impact? And the way that they were measuring impact was, how fast were you spending the money? And we were trying to be as prudent as possible with how we were spending the money. And we were also doing something else, which was investing in the Afghans. And one of the things I'm really proud of are the number of Afghan scientists and researchers that we were able to train, some of which are getting their PhDs in the U.S. now and in the U.K., we were criticized for that, and we were put under huge amounts of pressure to spend money faster. And we thought we really needed to be spending money smarter, rather than staying in the most luxurious hotel in the city in Kabul. You know, we all shacked up together within low-key guest houses and lived there. We did not have sort of the ostentation that some of the other organizations had, because we wanted the money to go to the organizations and the people and the institutions we were working with, as well as to get the data that we needed for conservation. And that's something WCS, I think, the Wildlife Conservation Society /Bronx Zoo, is very well known for.
Why did you leave the program before everything was complete?
I really didn't want to leave, but in the end, the pressure with USAID got to the point that I felt like I had to resign. The other issue that also made it a complicating factor was my father was getting much older. He was in his 80s, and I needed to go back and take care of him. So that made the decision a lot easier. My wife actually stayed on for more than another year in Afghanistan. Which wasn't fun for us, but it was the right decision for the program and for her within what we were doing. And but it was really difficult. The end result was much of what I saw in Afghanistan and other places like Madagascar with USAID, I wanted to address. And I had a chance to go back to USAID as the chief scientist to bring in a whole series of reforms and create something called the Global Development Lab with other people, and to think about how we transform development to meet the changing times.
So I didn't realize this, but there is an acronym that people are taught if they're going to be in a place where they might encounter a minefield. And that acronym is to tell you what to do when you realize you've wandered somewhere that might be dangerous. Can you tell us what the acronym is and what the letters stand for?
Yeah, I actually can't remember it exactly. The first step, because part of the reason was I was very bad at this, which you know, you'd see a golden eagle and you'd run out into the land, and all of a sudden you'd look at these linear patterns that looked like trenches, because they were trenches. You realize that you were standing in the no man's land, and that's probably heavily mined. But the first step is stop. I remember, I'm pretty sure the first thing is stop moving forward in whatever you're doing. And then I think, you know, it's looking around and retracing your steps backward and hoping that you don't blow up, which is an important sort of element of it. And we ran into mines more than once. They were as insidious as any of the terrorist groups. And the other issue was the drug trade. Actually limited some of our activities, because in some ways they were better armed than the Afghan army. They were the places where we thought that the Afghan cheetah, the Asiatic cheetah, was still in existence. And this is a cat species that's down to 40 individuals for the entire species. All in Iran, we believe that there's still a population in Afghanistan, because skins would turn up in the bazaars, and we wanted to try to go find it. It has enormous ranges because its prey base has become depleted, and those ranges were in areas that, again, people weren't going into because they were some of the most dangerous. Anytime you approach a border, you have a huge mine risk, and then you also have this risk, particularly on the Afghan-Iranian border, of the drug trade. And then on the Afghan-Pakistan border, we had issues with the insurgency and insurgent groups that posed significant risk to us.
Where were you when you were trying to convince people that the stamp that said canceled on your passport actually meant that you had a diplomatic passport? Or your visa, I should say.
Yeah, Tajikistan is a country that has a lot of holidays, and they seem to have holidays for everything where they just shut down the entire government. And I was on the Amu Darya, the river that separates Afghanistan and Tajikistan in the north, and I was on the Tajik side, and the border was closed, and I had to convince this Tajik soldier. He had asked me, "Do you have a diplomatic passport?" And I realized I still had my old diplomatic passports. They were marked with cancel and had giant holes in them. And then I had to somehow convince them that canceled meant valid, and somehow talked my way through it. And then and then we got to the boat, and we realized we were now stuck on no man's land, essentially a muddy riverbank, potentially for a couple of days, which would have meant I would have missed a flight to South Africa, where I was presenting on the Afghanistan program. And if it were not for Afghanistan, where the great thing about anything goes is that the country's never closed. And a former commander on the Afghan side sent over essentially a really, really dilapidated tugboat to come over and rescue us and rescue our vehicle.
So what state is the park in now? It was completed in 2009. Is that right?
Yeah. So there's multiple parks now. And that's the other great thing is, despite all the challenges in Afghanistan, the Wildlife Conservation Society is still working there. And that, to me, is pretty extraordinary. Now, they've focused their work less on Banda Amir, which is in Bamiyan province. And just as a reference, that's 60 miles from where the Buddhas were, and the Buddhas that were blown up by the Taliban. You have this incredible Grand Canyon plus stalactite lake complex that's pretty extraordinary. But what's kind of incredible is while the other park, which is this huge, vast area in the Himalayas and in fact connects to potentially parks in Pakistan, Tajikistan, and China. And one of our goals and the reason I was in Tajikistan was to try to create this transboundary peace park among all four countries. That area in the Himalayas gets tourists from the West. What's really interesting is that thousands of tourists in Afghanistan are still going to Banda Amir. So we didn't just create a park for foreigners. We literally, the first park is a park for the Afghans themselves. And that to me is important.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Just a couple other species I want to talk about before I let you go. Asiatic black bears are threatened in Afghanistan because they've historically been used, parts of their bodies have been used for medicine. And in fact, there are pharmacological benefits, but not benefits that can't be duplicated in a lab. Is that right?
Yeah, that's totally true. And one of the problems you have with, Chinese traditional medicine is there is a belief that by coming from a wild animal, there's literally a magic to that substance or that medicine. And so you have an effect, a placebo effect that might be created even when you have a perfectly good synthetic. And I think the best example is that of rhino horn. We have medicines for impotence that work well for people like Viagra, but there's still an incredible demand for rhino horn around the world. Now, most rhino horn actually doesn't go for health reasons. It goes through a carving market in Vietnam. It goes for cultural reasons, as well as increasingly we're seeing wealth, the ability to have such products as an indicator of status, driving the trade in such substances such as the black bear.
So you've worked in many, many countries. When you were in Afghanistan, you looked around you and you realized you were surrounded by expats who were adrenaline junkies, the journalists, the contractors, the aid workers. Can you explain what that's about? I mean, I work in a very safe office, and I don't have any desire to be in a dangerous place. But what is the appeal of working in a place where you're there to do good, but you also are there to kind of challenge yourself in a terrifying environment?
The saying we had about the dating scene was the odds are good, but the goods are odd. And I think, but one of the things that was interesting both about Afghanistan, Russia, as well as Iraq, was you were drawn by extraordinary people. You know, my wife would play ultimate frisbee with Rory Stewart, who wrote The Places in Between. Christina Lamb was a great friend. These are some, you know, she wrote I Am Malala, but a whole series of other books on Afghanistan. You would meet these people who literally went from one war zone to another. And that is because I think that there's two things. I think one is that these countries are at a point of inflection where small changes can have profound effects in their trajectory. So the ability to be in a place where you can have those kinds of effects, I think, is deeply appealing to some people, that, you know, it drives their very sense of identity in terms of why they go out and why they want to help. I think the adrenaline is also an important element of it, and an excitement, and the ability to work in places in the midst of fundamental change are all incredible attractants to them. And they develop, these places develop, particularly war zones, cultures of their own. In Russia, it's not a war zone, but during the transition from the Soviet Union to the Russian Federation, there is these crazy Gagarin parties, the first man to go into space, that would be raves in the middle of the woods that were, you know, that brought together these weird groups of expats. In Iraq, it seemed, and Afghanistan, it seemed to be Thai restaurants and Lebanese restaurants that would bring these people together. It is a unique, ephemeral, and interesting culture that you find in these places.
Alex Dagan is CEO and co-founder of Conservation X Labs and author of The Snow Leopard Project and Other Adventures in War Zone Conservation. Alex, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for spending this hour with us.
Thank you for having me.